Yeah.
Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Committee on Human Services Finance to order. Members, we have a quorum. I just wanted to ask Vice Chair Burner if he will move the approval of the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the approval of the minutes from our last meeting.
Vice Chair Burner moves the approval for the minutes for January 10, 2023, the Human Services Finance and Policy Joint Meeting. All those, any discussions? See none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The minutes for January 10, 2023 are now approved. With that, members, we have presentation on the Human Services Finance, and we have our distinguished guest here, the Chief Financial Officer, Dave Greenman, and we also have Budget Director, Bailey. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and we'll get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Greenman. I'm the Chief Financial Officer with the Department of Human Services.
And I'm Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you for having us here today to talk about our budget. As you know, DHS is a very large agency with a very large budget. We operate many programs. We deliver services using different methods, and we rely on a number of different funding sources. So we'll be providing you with a lot of information today. If there's any questions or if something's not clear, please let us know. Sometimes we get caught up in acronyms and we forget that not everybody knows what a IRTS is. We'll get started. Let's see. Okay. So to start with, we're going to talk a little bit about how we spend our money. And what our budget is, essentially. So this first slide is putting the Health and Human Services budget into context with the overall state budget. As you can see, this looks at funding from all different expenditures from all funding sources, so not just the state general fund, but other state dollars, and then also federal funds as well. And as you can see, Health and Human Services accounts for almost half of the state budget in the current biennium. When Health and Human Services includes the Department of Health, DHS, and also state licensing board or health licensing boards, and some ombudsperson offices as well, but overall DHS accounts for about 96% of that line on top. So we account for almost all of the spending. In the current biennium, our projected expenditures are approximately $48 billion. The fact that DHS is so large is probably not such a surprise because we touch the lives of approximately 1.7 million Minnesotans, which is almost a third of the state population. This next slide puts things into a little more context as well when we look at the general fund budget, which is obviously the main funding source that the state uses to finance our activities. When we just look at the general fund, the state general fund, K-12 education receives the most money, about 39%, and Health and Human Services is about 29% of that. So this slide shows the amount of funding, where the funding comes from that funds the Department of Human Services. Our budget in the current fiscal year, 2022, is about $23.2 billion. And as you can see, about over 60% of our budget comes from federal dollars, and the predominant federal funding source is Medicaid, a federal matching dollars that we receive on Medicaid. And I'll talk a little bit more about Medicaid in a bit. The general fund is obviously what you all direct appropriate to agencies throughout the state for expenditures. That's the main funding source. And we use a lot of our state general fund money to draw down federal dollars. We get a match on a lot of our spending to help meet our needs. When we look at this line, there's a line called other that people often ask about. And these are different types of dollars that we spend. Often it's pass-through dollars. For example, the department is the child support agency for the state. So we we collect child support payments and we pass them through to the, from the obligors and pass them through to the obligees. That's part of our budget, even though it just passes through us. We also collect a lot of money from the federal government on administrative, for administrative activities that we also pass through to our county partners and our tribal partners as well for the administrative work that they do. So we help to fund them as well, or we don't help to fund them, but we pass through the dollars that they receive. Another item that is a major part of our budget is the Healthcare Access Fund. That's been around since the early 90s, and it's historically been used to finance the Minnesota Care Health Insurance Program, which is a program that provides health coverage for lower-income Minnesotans who do not qualify for medical assistance. And individuals on that program pay a premium. However, since the passage of the ACA back in 2010, the state has started to administer what's called a basic health program, which is allowed under federal law. It provides a certain set of health benefits and needs to meet certain requirements under federal law. And so that's basically what Minnesota Care has become. It's become our basic health plan. And we get federal funding for that, and that's basically what we get is these are people who could buy coverage through the private exchange, but instead they go on the basic health plan. And what the state receives is we get 95% of the tax credit that the individuals enrolled in the program would have received if they purchased coverage through the private sector. So those are the federal dollars that we receive. And in the last several years, the federal funds have almost completely paid for the Minnesota Care Program or the basic health plan. So as a result, the biggest expenditure from the Healthcare Access Fund is medical assistance right now. The legislature's started to appropriate funds for that. The Healthcare Access Fund is mainly financed through a tax assessed on healthcare provider revenues and a 1% tax on HMO premium revenue. The provider tax is typically 1.8%. However, there's a provision in statute that says that if revenues come in at 125% of projected expenditures, then the next calendar year the provider tax is temporarily reduced. So in the current calendar year, 2023, the provider tax has been reduced to 1.6% by statute. And that's the first time that's happened since the contingent reduction language was put in statute. And the balance on the Healthcare Access Fund in 2025 is about $960 million. So it's got a fairly healthy balance. Next, special revenue funds. These are dollars that that are actually not direct appropriated to us, so you won't see the special revenue fund dollars being appropriated in the finance bill at the end of session. They're actually appropriated in statute to us. And it's not a specific amount. It's like fee revenue that we collect. That money is appropriated to us, and we use that money to do whatever the fees we're collecting are for, licensing, background studies, things like that. We also have authority to put some dollars into the special revenue fund, like our IT expenditures. We have a systems account that we transfer dollars into the systems account, which is a special revenue fund, and we also get to draw down the federal funds that we generate on our state spending on IT work, and that goes into the systems account as well to help pay for those things. So that's our special revenue fund. And the last thing I was going to talk about is our federal temporary assistance for needy families block grant. That's a federal block grant that the state's been receiving since about 1997. It's usually about $268 million a year. And the funds are allowed to be used under federal law for purposes that support families with children. It's very specific uses that were allowed on that. And they are those dollars are direct appropriated by the legislature. In the past, we've used them mainly for funding the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which is our economic assistance program for families with children. We've also, TANF dollars are also used for child care assistance and also for grants to counties counties and tribes for workforce training and things like that. And a small amount of TANF dollars goes to the health department for allowable activities there as well. So that's where a lot of our dollars come from that we spend. So this
CFO Freeman, yes, I think there's a member question. Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question about the provider tax. As a border city, I represent Moorhead. You know, we're right up against Fargo. And so it actually is one of the things that a lot of the providers have talked to me about. I just want to make sure that the 1.6 is that statewide, or are there any considerations, or is there anything specific for those border cities who we lose physicians and they are housed in North Dakota because of things like this? So I would just like your input or your feedback on that.
Mr. Chair, I think that discussion's gone. I think that's been an ongoing conversation about the impact of the provider tax on providers, especially like in border communities like yours. There is not currently any allowance for it's. It is a statewide tax. It's collected the same rate.
You may proceed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this next slide might take a little bit of explaining, but it's pretty important because it's showing the rate at which we draw down federal funds on our Medicaid expenditures, and we draw down in the neighborhood of about $15 billion a year in federal funds through our Medicaid expenses. And as you know, Medicaid is jointly funded, or medical assistance is jointly funded by the state and federal government. The federal share of the cost is referred to as the federal medical assistance percentage, or FMAP. And the FMAP, a standard FMAP rate, is established for each state based on its per capita income, and it's adjusted every federal fiscal year. The standard FMAP rate on the slide you're looking at is in blue. So it's as you can see, initially it's been about 50%, and that's the lowest in the nation. That you can't go any under federal law, it can't be any lower than 50%. So Minnesota has traditionally been at 50%. We don't get any more than that. That's the minimum. The maximum that some states get is I think as high as 77%. But over the last couple of years, the Minnesota FMAP rate has been inching up slowly. Initially, it was increased in the current fiscal year at about 50.51%. Then next year, it's expected to go up to 50.79, and then up to 51.62. So it has been inching up in Minnesota, and this does make it's a small amount, but it actually, because of the program, Medicaid is so large, it actually does have a pretty significant impact on our budget. And we refer to it as a standard FMAP rate because there are special rates that we get on certain populations in Medicaid. For example, adults without children, the FMAP rate is actually 90%. So we only pay 10% of the cost of medical assistance for adults without children enrolled in MA in that eligibility group. We also receive a higher FMAP rate for the CHIP program, for children and Children's Health Insurance Program. Under the federal Family First Coronavirus Relief Act that was passed early in the pandemic, the federal government provided states with a 6.2% increase in their FMAP rate for each quarter in which there's the public health emergency is in place. And as you know, it's still in place, but it sounds like it's coming to an end. So for about the last several years, we've been getting an additional 6.2% on our FMAP rate. And in order to receive that higher 6.2%, we're required to maintain what's called continuous eligibility, which is we don't do redeterminations during this period. We don't, we have to maintain basically eligibility. There's very limited opportunities to sort of review eligibility for the program. However, under the 2023 federal law the budget that just passed, the FMAP is being phased down from, as you can see on the slide, it's down to 5% for one federal quarter, then it's down to 2.5%, then 1.5%, and at the end of this calendar year, it'll be gone, basically, and we'll be back to our normal, just standard Medicaid rate. In the federal forecast, we've been tracking the state forecast, we've been tracking how much we're getting from the 6.2% FMAP rate, or special rate, plus what we're spending as a result of the continuous eligibility requirements. Over the period since January of 2020, we've gotten about $2.63 billion in additional federal funding as a result of the higher FMAP rate. We've spent additional $845 million to maintain the continuous eligibility, and then so that the net impact is about, on the state budget, is about $1.79 billion over the period of the public health emergency. So I thought this would be helpful to see, just because it's got a big impact on the budget.
Member questions, CFO Greenman. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Greenman. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how that FMAP percentage is determined by state and what has factored into the fact that Minnesota has the lowest FMAP rate.
Mr. Chair, I can tell you on a fairly high level, I think in the terms of the details, we probably want to get a little more information for you, but it's essentially an analysis of a per capita income in the state. So states with higher per capita income are going to get a lower FMAP rate. They're going to be closer to the 50% top rate, and states with a lower per capita income are going to get a higher rate. I believe West Virginia right now has the highest FMAP rate in the country.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just explain, I don't think the public has an idea of what the enhanced eligibility truly means and during the pandemic. And then also, could you let us know, with limited opportunities to review eligibility, are there people that possibly are getting assistance that maybe shouldn't be? And if that's the case, what happens when the federal government says, you know what, we're not renewing the emergency anymore? Will the individuals that are currently receiving assistance be then liable for anything that they shouldn't have qualified for?
I think the question is about the continuous eligibility and the federal rules that we're operating. The requirement for us to receive the enhanced FMAP and the renewals that are due to start in April. So I just wanted to make it clear.
I thought my question was clear.
No, I just wanted people, the renewal based on, I think, what we understand. It's a state nationwide process. The enhanced FMAP we're receiving to continue eligibility for anyone so that we don't do recertification, we don't do eligibility review. So every state and everywhere, this came through the CARES Act, it continued.
Correct.
And right now it's being phased out based on the Appropriation Act that passed in December and signed into law. So that means the state of Minnesota and every state will have to come up with a plan to review eligibility for 1.5 million individuals who are receiving, and some of them may not be eligible based on the requirement under the federal rules. And that means some people may lose their eligibility. We'll have more conversation about that. But I just wanted to make sure that members understand this has been an ongoing. It's not something that started last year. It has been ongoing for CFO Green.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, the continuous eligibility requirements in federal law are very specific about what a state can and can't or should or shouldn't do in terms of eligibility for the program and enrollment in the program. And we've been paying very close attention to what those requirements are. In fact, early in the pandemic, they were sort of being modified from quarter to quarter. And so we've had to pay quite a bit of attention to those. Essentially, we don't do, unless somebody reaches out to us, we often don't do a redetermination. And so there are likely people on the program who have continued to be on the program even though their circumstances may have changed that would change their eligibility for the program. So that's the purpose of sort of this massive task we've got ahead of us now as the public health emergency ends. We've got, you know, essentially a number of months, you know, 12 months or so to redetermine eligibility for all 1.5 million people. So yes, there's probably people on the program who don't currently meet eligibility requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just talking about Minnesota. So yes, I understand it's the entire country, but we're dealing with Minnesota today. So what happens then when you redetermine eligibility and you find out that maybe, let's just say, a third of those individuals were not qualified to be on those programs? Then where does the liability? Does the liability rely go on to the individual that was collecting the benefits who shouldn't have been, or is the state going to say, well, we're just going to suck it up and maybe we should have done a better job?
CFO Green.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen, I look to some other folks to maybe clarify this later, but I believe we would consider the people eligible now until we, because we haven't redetermined their eligibility until public health emergency unwind starts. We would determine them to continue to be eligible until we do the redetermination, and once we do that, then we would determine whether they're eligible. We don't know, I mean, we wouldn't, if we find that they're ineligible, we don't know when they became ineligible, so we wouldn't have any way to sort of identify when they became ineligible and when we're receiving services. So I don't think the federal government would permit us to go back and reclaim resources from people. This is essentially the rules that we're living under with the continuous eligibility requirements.
CFO Grimm, just to make sure that people understand, we turned off all the wage matches and everything based on the federal requirement that we continued with the eligibility. So this continuous eligibility is a requirement from the federal government in order for us to continue to receive the funding that we have, even including the additional FMAP that we expect, the 5%, 2.5, and 1.5, there are conditions in terms of discontinuing eligibility for individuals, so that we have to follow due diligence and make sure that individuals who are eligible continue to do so, and those who we cannot find, we have the appropriate mechanism to make sure that we take not just a return of mail will discontinue eligibility for individuals. There's more requirement, and we have to follow the federal rules in order for us to continue to receive the additional funds. CFO Grimm.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'll go to the next slide, which shows changes in the department's expenditures over time by funding source. So this gives a sense of how the agency expenditures have grown over time, particularly in the last several years. And I think you can see here, at least some of this is a result of COVID and some of the federal legislation that's passed that's provided additional funds to states to help them deal with a number of the public health issues related to COVID and also to deal with some of the economic impacts of COVID. So we've received quite a bit of federal funds for child care stabilization grants. We've also received funding for homeless shelters, and I think another large source of funding has been for nutrition. So that's helped, that's come from federal legislation, and so you can see the growth in spending over time there. And every time we do one of these slideshows, I always see a slide that I wish I'd fixed before we came over, and this actually doesn't fully show our spending amount. So the next slide you'll see, actually our spending is actually increasing in 24 and 25 as well, but I'll get to that in just a second. And there you go. So this shows actual and projected growth in agency expenditures. This is similar to the slide you just saw, except it's got actual dollar amounts on the increase in the department's expenditures. What we also inserted here, because we felt is important, is to show the staffing levels at the department and how those have changed over time. From 2018 to 2025, the overall department budget is expected to grow by about 45%. While our staffing levels are projected to grow by about 2%. And I think I certainly wouldn't quibble to anybody who said DHS is a large agency. We are a large agency. We have a lot of staff. About two-thirds of our staff work in our direct care and treatment program, and so most of what you're seeing on that top line is in direct care and treatment. However, if you just took them out and just put in central office staff, you'd see about that same line. It's a growth of about 2%. So you're seeing what we're experiencing at the department is a growth in responsibility, in accountability, and as Commissioner Harpstead has talked about a lot, you know, we're working to be compliant, we're working to be a trustworthy agency, but I wouldn't be telling you the truth if I didn't say it's putting a lot of strain on us to have a budget grow at this level, and the different types of funding sources we're having to manage, and the programs we're having to see men with staffing levels not going up. We've done a lot around process improvements. We've been a big focus with our Swiss Watch project, and a lot of things to maintain financial accountability in our financial operations, and those have really helped quite a bit. But one thing I'd note is that the people make the decisions, the systems don't, and the process improvements don't make decisions. They don't make accountability judgments. It's really the people. And so in the last several years, there has been a lot of stress on the department dealing with additional funds that we've got coming in.
CFO Grimm, just two quick questions, hopefully. We'll start with Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Comparing 7 and 8, those slides, I'm seeing on slide 7, between 22 and 23, about a 40% increase in the general fund spending from 6.568 to 9.01. But when I look at the next slide and you show your total budget, I'm not seeing that increase between 22 and 23, which is not an inconsequential jump just in that fund, but actually it's an increase in all the funds. And so that makes me wonder, why am I seeing such a discrepancy between related slides?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, that's what I was referring to a few minutes ago when I said I wish I could have fixed the slides, because the slide on number 7 is missing a small amount of the agency budget that is not, like you said, it's not immaterial. It's some of our enterprise funds that aren't being included. And so probably the more, I think the proportions of spending that fall between federal, general fund, and other are probably the same in slide 7, even though some of the expenditure data is missing. But if you go to slide, I think we're on slide 9 now. This particular slide, this has all of the funds in it right here. So that's why I was saying earlier that it's missing some data in a little bit of the data in the earlier slide. So,
Mr. Yeah. Chair.
Representative Clark.
I'd like, when they find the data that's missing, and correct the slides, that they send us an updated version.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, we're happy to do that.
Please proceed. We've got another question. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Greenman. Also on slide 8, where you're showing the FTEs, it's a little unusual for the legislature to cut FTEs, and so I'm wondering why the FTEs are going down. I'm assuming that's in large part a function of workforce availability, and I'm wondering if you know what percentage of your currently available FTE positions are unfilled right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brindley, the reason why FTEs go down is because, like any other organization, we obviously have to live within our budget, and we can't spend more than we have. Mm-hmm. Over time, there are, like any other organization, we're subject to inflationary impacts. And from year to year, we experience an increase in costs, and we may not experience an increase in revenue, if you will, to cover those costs. So over time, we can basically afford to purchase less because the costs go up, but our budget doesn't go up by an equal amount. So there needs to be decisions made about how do we balance our budget, and so we have to look at ways in which to do that and to continue to operate within our existing resources. And sometimes, when you're an agency like ours, where you have obligations, you have contracts, we have services and programs we need to operate. Our first priority is getting services out to people, serving the population. We need to look at where we can sort of make reductions, economies of scale, different kinds of things to increase efficiency. And sometimes it also means that if a position is open and it's not, a person retires, sometimes a decision has to be made that we're not going to fill that position because we need to balance our budget. And we that's one way in which we can reduce spending in the short run to make it something fit within our budget. So we do have some unfilled positions. I don't have that number right in front of with me right now, but we can certainly get that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd be very interested to know how many unfilled positions there are. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think one thing I would just add, though, is they're unfilled because they're unfunded, that we don't have the resources to afford all the positions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate some clarification on that, actually. So you are saying that every single position that you have posted in DHS has been filled?
Mr. Chair, no, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that when we say unfilled positions, there's a different way, and I apologize if I wasn't being clear. There are positions that we have at DHS that are funded, obviously, and we're I shouldn't say obviously, but and we're certainly posting them and filling them. There, however, when you look at the overall number of positions at the department that on the slide, it does go up and down, and sometimes it goes up and down because there are decisions made in order to make us fit within our budget, that sometimes we don't fill a position. Just when there's a retirement, when somebody leaves, we often look for ways in which how can we continue to operate, continue to deliver services. How is it that we can make decisions that, you know, to work within our budget? And sometimes that involves not filling a position that's open. So I apologize if I wasn't clear, but we obviously do fill positions. We're often hiring a lot of positions because of the workforce issue, which it's hard to keep people. And so we're often hiring people, particularly in the direct care and treatment area. So we do hire a lot of people, but sometimes as a way, like I said, as a way to stay within our budget, sometimes we don't fill a position. And that's maybe why you're seeing a lot of why you're seeing.
Quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, what I am interested in is knowing what positions you have funded, posted, that are unfilled. That's the number that I am looking for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. CFO Greenman. We'll take two more questions, and then please hold on your question until we're done with the presentation because there's a lot to cover here. Representative Hicks.
I just wanted to kind of circle back around to what you were saying about workforce, because when we were in our joint meeting, we heard a lot about the frustrations around NET study, and we heard a lot about provider frustrations around getting enrollment processed and some of those pieces. And the department shared how the backlog and the lack of positions has really affected those things. And so since we're having this conversation, I just wanted to check in. Are those some of the positions we're talking about here?
CFO Green.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't speak specifically for those. I know that, but I do know that if it's a high priority position, we make every effort to get it filled. And every position's a high priority, but I think the ones you're talking about in particular, we're hearing a lot about. We know that's critical to our mission, is to get providers into the system so that they can serve our clients. So I think those. I don't think that there are many of those, but I can certainly check to see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very quick. CFO Greenman, we were talking a little bit earlier, and this may help clarify what Representative New Brindley was asking earlier. Can you tell us how many new positions we've authorized as the legislature and how many of those were actually filled over the last few years? Going back to the numbers we were talking about just a little bit earlier this today.
CFO Greenman.
Sure. Representative Fisher, Chairman Neuer. Since 2018, basically since the 2017 legislative session ended, the legislature has funded approximately 388 new positions in the DHS central office. So that doesn't include direct care and treatment. However, because of inflationary impacts that affect our budget and affect our ability to continue to pay for the same level of services and needing to sort of meet our budget needs, we've the actual net increase in FTEs at the department has gone up by about 41. So there has been a lot of new positions added, but there's also been the need to look at what we can do within to continue to operate within our operating budget. for example, if we get money for medical assistance, we can't use that for staffing. We only can use our operating budget for that. So we have a limited operating budget that doesn't automatically increase every year, but we do see inflationary increases every year. And so we have to continue to monitor our budget and make whatever changes we can so that we continue to have a balanced budget. And so one of the impacts, we have to do a lot to try to save money, much more than just simply not filling positions. We do a lot around, I could talk a lot about things we've done to change the way we deliver services that require less staffing or, using technology to improve the way we deliver services for less money. But one of the things we've had to do is look at, is there a way we can do things with fewer staff? And sometimes we've had to do that. So
we'll come back for the other question, but I just wanted to get one clarifying issue. If the budget that was allocated for FTE is not used within that period, it cancels to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Operating dollars that are appropriated in the first year of the biennium, so this would be fiscal year 24, could carry forward into 25, but if they're not spent at the end of 25, they cancel back to the general fund.
Thank you. You may proceed, Chair.
So this next slide shows, breaks out our agency expenditures by the different spending categories. So as you can see, not surprisingly, medical assistance is by far the largest area of expenditures for the department, almost three-quarters of our spending. Grant programs account for about 10% of our spending, and that's actually been a significant increase in the last several years. This would include something like competitive grants that you appropriate dollars for specific activities or for specific grant programs that we use, and also block grants, which are dollars that go to the counties or the tribal governments. I'm thinking of things like the Adult Mental Health Initiative grants, where there's each county and each tribal government gets an allocation based on a formula and statute, and that goes out the door that way. So those are the grant programs. We also have non-MA forecasted programs that Ms. Bailey's going to talk a little bit more about in a bit, and that's about 7.5% of our budget. Those are things like the Minnesota Family Investment Program, the Child Care Assistance Program for MFIP, and things like the Housing Support Program. Direct care and treatment accounts for about 2.4% of our expenditures. And then their operational spending and our budget accounts for about 2.6%. And that includes things like the payroll, the central office staff, professional technical contracts, our IT spending, other things that go into operating our agency. And that's really the budget where the staffing comes from. So what we've all been talking about in the last several minutes about our staffing budget, that's really where it comes out of our operating budget. So just want to make that clear. So this is where you can see where our FTEs are, our staffing levels are allocated. As you can see, direct care and treatment, even though, like I just said, it's only 2.4% of our budget, it's actually basically two-thirds of our staffing levels, because this is our complex behavioral health care system in the state that we operate throughout the state. I'll talk a little bit more about what services we provide through direct care and treatment in a few minutes, but that's our biggest staffing level, because this is where we provide direct services on a 24/7 basis. The rest of the staffing is in our central office operating budget. The FTEs in our operating administration include things like the Office of Inspector General, which conducts licensing, background studies, fraud prevention, those kinds of activities. Some of the other staffing we have includes healthcare is another big area, because they do a lot of issues around provider enrollment and just operating the Medicaid program is a big task. And then you can see the staffing levels in the central office for the other parts of the administration, of other administrations. Altogether, we have about 6,800 FTEs at the department. So next, we'll talk a little bit about who we serve. And this is really the important part. This is where we talk about the Minnesotans that are actually receiving our services. What this slide shows is that about breaks it down on the right by different population groups. So about 620,000 children, or 48% of the children in Minnesota, are touched somehow by the Department of Human Services, whether that's through child care assistance, through the Minnesota Family Investment Program, through maybe this would include things like obviously medical assistance and things like child welfare, other programs that specifically are targeted towards serving kids. There are about 930,000 adults and parents that receive services or are touched through DHS. Again, medical assistance, housing assistance would be part of this, behavioral health grants, and grants for support for work activities through the MFIT program as well. And then services, about 150,000 older adults, or 17% of the older adults in the state, receive services through the department as well. And this could include long-term care services through medical assistance and also basic health care, other grants that we provide to help people live independently in their homes. And then about 230,000 Minnesotans with disabilities, or about 37% of the people with disabilities in Minnesota, receive services through the department, through a lot of our waiver programs that Ms. Bailey is going to talk about, through medical assistance, and then also obviously medical assistance, the basic health care services, other grants that we provide, again, to help people live independently as possible. And then this provides maybe some more numbers on specific programs. As you can see, medical assistance, we have about 1.3 million Medicaid enrollees, and that enrollment has gone up since the beginning of the public health emergency, as we've had the continuous eligibility requirements in place. This represents 1.3 million represents the enrollment in probably around January of 22, so about a year ago. We're closing in on probably around 1.5 million in terms of enrollment today. And so that's the number that we're going to be looking at as we go at starting next year with our public health and wine when we do redeterminations. You can see in the upper right that these are sort of the ongoing or continuing care services for people with disabilities and older Minnesotans. You can see enrollment in nursing facilities is about 11,600 average monthly, and home and community-based waivers, which serve both persons with disabilities and elderly people to live in the community, has an enrollment of about 86,000. Other information in here, we have about 445,000 people in Minnesota on the SNAP program. That's not a state program. That's a federal program that we administer. So that's the number of people served through that program per month. So next we'll talk a little bit about direct care and treatment. So DCT is a small percentage of our budget, but we serve over 12,000 people per year in Minnesota in our programs. So we want to spend a little bit of time talking about that. There are multiple programs within direct care and treatment. DCT is the people we serve primarily are people with behavioral health, substance use disorder, and developmental disabilities, and also people with a number of different co-occurring conditions. We operate a variety of programs through DCT in over 200 sites throughout the state, ranging from hospitals such as the Anoka Regional Treatment Center to single-family homes where clients live in the community and receive services. Most of our clients are court-ordered to be placed in treatment. And DCT clients often have behavioral health issues and other co-occurring conditions that are not able to be served in the private sector. And that's why they come through DHS for these services. So what this slide shows is the expenditures by program area. The top one with $146 million budget is our mental health and substance use services. And this includes services provided at our Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, our community-based behavioral health hospitals that are located throughout the state. These are smaller hospitals. We have a child and adolescent behavioral health program in Willmar that serves children with unique behavioral health needs. We also have intensive regional treatment centers and operate a community addiction recovery enterprise as well. The next item is the community-based services, and these are the services that are provided in primarily in smaller settings, and these are residential and crisis services to adults and adolescents and also adult vocational services to individuals with intellectual disabilities. So these are the services we provide more or less in the community. We also have a forensics hospital in St. Peter, as well as a nursing home for individuals in the forensic system as well. The sex offender program has a budget of about $101 million, and that's located on campuses in both Moose Lake and St. Peter. And then finally, our DCT operations has a budget of about $55 million. The total budget for direct care and treatment is about $557 million. Their budget comes from direct appropriations from you. It also comes from, a number of the services we offer are what's known as enterprise services, where we're expected to collect revenues sufficient to fund the operations of the programs. We have several of those types of services that we provide. In some cases, those revenues don't cover the costs, and so we do get some appropriations for those as well. We also rely on Medicaid spending. We are a Medicaid provider for some of the services that we deliver. So DCT has gets funded through different sources of revenue that operates both as a state agency, if you will, and also also operates in a sense in the private healthcare system. So it does both. It's complicated. It's a complex system. Then this next slide shows you the staffing levels at DCT. So we have about 4,500 staff based on the most recent projections. Most of those staff work in our community-based services, so in our smaller settings. About 1,400 people work there. And then, as you can see, the other staff, about 1,100 in our health and substance use area, 1,000 in forensics, and about 780 in the sex offender program. So the next, I'll briefly cover grants, and then I'll turn it over to Ms. Bailey. So this slide shows our grant expenditures for 2022. The total DHS spending on grants was about $2.47 billion. As you can see, the largest grant area is nutrition and housing. And the reason it's so big is because it includes our SNAP program. So this is where our SNAP spending happens. We provide SNAP to over 400,000 or 445,000 Minnesotans right now, paid for through the federal government, but administered through DHS. Children and community services includes things like child and adult protection, child welfare, and child support enforcement. Child care includes the basic sliding fee program. We have two child care assistance programs. One is the MFIP program, which is for families on MFIP who are just leaving MFIP, which is a forecasted program that Ms. Bailey's going to talk about. The other is the basic sliding fee program, and you all appropriate the funds for that program. So that's got a fixed appropriation, and that's most of the child care funding is in that area, is basic sliding fee program. We also provide behavioral health grants, and this includes adult mental health grants, children's mental health grants, and substance use disorder funding. And finally, employment services grants are mainly funded with TANF dollars that I talked about earlier. And these are funds, dollars we use to provide services to employment training and other things to break down barriers to employment for families receiving our assistance. This last slide on grants is showing you how it's changed over time. And as you can see, there's a big jump since 2020, and this is largely it's largely on the federal side, although there is a growth in state spending, but it's largely the response to COVID and the additional funding that the state's gotten that's gone through DHS to deal with things like homelessness, nutrition assistance, and child care subsidies as well. So that's our federal, that's our grant expenditures over time. With that, I'm happy to answer more questions on this. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Ms. Bailey to talk about our forecasted programs.
We'll go directly to Director Bailey, and then we'll come to the questions.
All right, well, I'll jump right in. So as Mr. Greenman kind of noted in his overall budget presentation, our forecasted programs take up a huge majority of our budget. It's about 80% of our total budget, and we serve over 1.4 million people through the funds you see on the screen. That's our total budget, so about $18 billion, but if we were just looking at general fund state funds, about $6 billion. So in this area of our spending, a lot of federal funds coming through the state. MA, within our forecasted programs, MA makes up about 91% of the total forecasted spending. And so you'll see on this chart the different eligibility and program areas of our MA program, with the top line being our long-term care and home and community-based services. This makes up about 33% of our forecasted spending. These are services provided to people with disabilities and older adults in the community and in facility-based care. The next three lines are what we call basic care, so the traditional medical care provided to people on medical assistance, differentiated by their eligibility criteria. So families with kids is about 20% of our forecasted spending. The basic care provided to people with disabilities and older adults, about 19% and 18% of total spending on adults without kids. You'll see further down in the graph that 3.4% of our forecasted spending is on Minnesota care. And then the rest, about 6% of the total forecasted spending is on the rest of our forecasted programs. So those are things like MFIP, our cash assistance programs, child care, housing supports, and behavioral health supports. Diving deeper into our healthcare programs, this slide just kind of gives a snapshot in time. So in fiscal year 2022, we had over $16 billion spent on MA at an average of 1.3 million people per month. Minnesota Care is a smaller program, $637 million total, with about 105 people enrolled each month. Thanks. Yeah. This next slide just depicts the total spending on MA by the funding type. So you'll see, I'm gonna kind of, yeah, it's easier. as Mr. Greenman kind of outlined earlier in the presentation, we've seen quite an uptick in federal funding in our MA program, particularly due to that enhanced federal match throughout the pandemic. So you'll see the uptick in 22 and 23, and then kind of projected to reduce slightly over time as we embark on the unwinding efforts. This next slide just shows the number of people that are served within each of the categories that I went over earlier. You'll see the biggest chunk of the population are families with kids, followed by adults without kids and people with disabilities and older adults. This next slide goes over the distribution of our enrollment across the state. So you'll see in the metro, we have about 21% of the population receives healthcare through our MA program. And they encompass about 54% of the entire program, given the size of the population. And then you'll see that the biggest area of the state that has the highest concentration per capita of people receiving health coverage through Minnesota MA is in the northwest corner of the state at 25%. This next slide goes over our population by race and ethnicity compared to the overall population in Minnesota. And these are some statistics along with the previous slide in our Medicaid Matters dashboard. So I would point you all there if you want to dig a little bit deeper into the people that are served on our Medicaid program. It's a really fantastic dashboard. Here you can see our overall population in Minnesota of African-American and black is about 7%, but on the MA program, it's about 19.8%. And you can look at the rest of the slide here. This next slide just shows our different categories within the MA program, the total cost that we typically have per month per person. The total cost over time, and then the average number of people we serve in the population. So you'll see again the kids and families encompass a large population within our MA program, but they're actually a lower amount total spend at $3.7 billion. The largest spend is on our older adults and people with disabilities category. We spend about $9.5 billion in 1 year on 187,000 people. And of course, it's due to the fact that the costs of the services cost more. This next slide goes over the trends over time in the cost per person by services and eligibility category. And what's telling about this slide is the top line is our long-term care facilities, and showing that it's a much steeper curve upward than other areas in our MA budget. This next slide is a similar slide, but just shows the total annual expenditures. So rather than an average per person, it's encompassing the total number of people and the total units billed across all of the program. And so you'll see the top line here is the long-term care waivers, where we're seeing a big growth, particularly in the number of people served, and I'll go into that a bit later. Well, I'm going into it right now. This slide shows just changes we've seen since way back, 1993 to 2025, on how people have chosen to receive care in the long-term care industry. And you'll see in about 2000, the lines crossed between people choosing to receive care in a institution or a long-term care facility, and those that are receiving care in their home and in the community through waivers and home care. So you'll see that change growing over time at a dramatic pace. And this next slide is just a snapshot in time, digging a little bit deeper into the number of people by program and setting in the long-term care support area. So in 2020, about 21,000 people received services through the MA program in nursing facilities. 22,000 people received care through the disability waivers in residential settings. So those are group homes, assisted livings, customized living. 36,000 people received disability waivers in their own home, and 46,000 people received care through the personal care assistance program. And home care, 27,000, and then we also serve older adults through the elderly waiver and alternative care program. Those are folks that are living in their own home or in an assisted living receiving care. This next slide shows the disability waivers over time and how they have grown by waiver. The blue part of the graph is the DD waiver, the developmental disability waiver. This is a waiver for folks that who need a level of care provided in an intermediate care facility. And so in 2022, we served over 24,000 people on this program at an average cost of about $81,000 a year. The green part of the graph is what we call the CADI waiver, which is Community Access for Disability Inclusion. And this is a waiver for people with disabilities who require a level of care in a nursing facility. And that has grown, as you can see, probably the largest growth over time in this graph. And way back, I think in 2015 or 2016, we had caps on that waiver that were lifted. And so there was a lot of unmet demand for that program that has continued to grow and serve people in their own homes since those have been lifted. We also have two smaller waiver programs serving people with disabilities. One's called the CAC, or the Community Alternative Care Waiver, and this serves people who are chronically ill or medically fragile who would require a level of care even higher, a level of care in a hospital. And so it's a pretty small program. We serve about 700 people at an average cost of $84,000 a year. And then the brain injury waiver is the other, the red piece of this graph. And this is a waiver for people who have acquired or traumatic brain injuries who need a level of care provided in a nursing home that provides specialized services for their care. And it's also a small program. We serve over 1,100 people at an average cost of $96,000. So that is the highest per person cost among the disability waivers. This next slide shows the growth in the elderly waiver program. So in 2022, we served over 30,000 people in the elderly waiver. And you'll see a little bit, some dips in here due to financing methods for managed care shifts having to do with when we actually pay the claims from year to year. But overall, you'll see growth over time with this program as well. And then lastly, with the long-term care piece, this is the trends in long-term care facilities. So in 2022, we served over 23,000 people at an average cost per month of $7,300. You might have seen in our forecast in November that the average caseload has been dropping, and it's actually been declining for over 20 years due to the shift from facility-based care to those waiver and home care programs. And you'll also see an increase in the average payment, though, since the implementation of the value-based reimbursement, or VBR, that occurred in 2016. So facilities in this program get annual increases based on the costs that they incurred in the years prior. And then this calendar year, that rate increase exceeded 9%. I'll jump into the non-MA forecasted programs. And this slide just kind of gives a brief snapshot of our total spending for each of those programs. This next slide shows the Minnesota Care enrollment. So as Mr. Greenman noted, Minnesota Care is our other public health program that serves people who do not qualify for Minnesota Care or MA, but they're still low income. I believe they have to be within 200% of the federal poverty guideline to qualify for this program. And they do pay a small premium to access Minnesota Care, although those premiums have been reduced throughout the pandemic from federal law. This next slide shows the total spending over time by the federal and state share. And as Mr. Greenman noted, our state share is actually pretty small in this program. And the federal share has actually grown tremendously just in the last forecast due to different ways that they are calculating the BHP revenue that we'll receive. This next slide goes over the Minnesota Family Investment Program, and it just shows the expenditures that we have had over time, along with the number of families served. So you'll see the line above is showing a slight decrease in the number of people receiving MFIP, and the average payments increasing over time. Just kind of going quickly, the Minnesota Family Investment child care piece. So as Mr. Greenman noted, we have two child care programs. This is the Minnesota Family Investment Program that is the forecasted program. Our basic sliding fee spending is not in this slide because it is technically a grant program and is not forecasted. So you'll see here the federal dollars in 2022 and 2023 have pretty much covered the total cost of this program. due to declines in the total amount we're projecting to spend. And then this next slide just gives a snapshot of our other cash programs. So we also serve people through the General Assistance, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, and our housing support programs, and the spending over time. The housing support program has gone up over time, while the Minnesota Supplemental Aid and General Assistance have relatively stayed flat. And we put some good resources in the slide deck for you that would be, if you want to dig in deeper, there's a plethora of resources to look into. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you so much, Director Bailey. I know there are a few individuals who raised their hand. If you want to be added to the list, please let me know. Representative Zelenska.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And thank you, DHS. I have a question on the data for current licensed long-term care settings. Do you know the number that we have right now for nursing homes in the state of Minnesota?
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Representative, I do not have it with me, but we can gather that for you.
Thank you. I'd have a follow-up.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I would like to also ask if you could give us the licensed community-based, the assisted living facilities, that actually facilities, the number that we have right now, and if we could see that data so we can see. My guess is the elderly waiver spending is increasing in these settings because we've delicensed nursing home beds, closed beds across Minnesota at a time when we have the fastest growing population called the baby boomers and various level of need across the state. So I'd like to see what the numbers look like right now, if possible. Thank you.
We'll go to Vice Chair. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question actually, and I'm not sure, I think this is, if I'm reading this correctly, and what you had said, you were talking about the MFIT program in particular and how the amount that we're paying out per family has increased, but the number of families that we're serving is going down. And so looking at that trend, could you speak a little bit to the reasons for why we're seeing less folks served? Is that, are we seeing less folks served because there isn't as much money in the budget? It's just, the budget's not stretching as far? Or what are the factors that are playing into that trend?
Director Boone.
Chair Noor, Representative, I believe it is a reflection of where the economy is at this time and impacts of the pandemic, where we saw just an enrollment in the people signing up for MFIP going down over time. And that's also the case with MFIP childcare. We saw steep declines in folks receiving the childcare benefit, and we had expected it to kind of resume to normal after the pandemic, but here we are still seeing not an uptick that we were expecting. And so I think it's largely around the economic conditions we have today on employment, but also some blurriness with coming out of a pandemic.
Representative Neuer. One thing I just wanted to add to what Ms. Bailey said is that MFIP is not strictly an entitlement program, but I'd say it's pretty close. For the most part, if you're eligible, you can be on the program. There are some rules in federal law, but they don't tend to do a lot to diminish the program. So essentially, it's not a matter of not having enough money. For the most part, if people want to be or are eligible, then they can be enrolled in the program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Billy, and for that. I'm curious, I do know that there's also the sliding fee scale in here as well, and I know that we were talking about expecting things to sort of resurge back to normal a little bit as things have started to normalize a little bit, as we're sort of kind of, I don't want to say we're coming out of the pandemic, but kind of it's becoming a little bit more normalized. So I'm curious, you know, with a lot of folks not applying, is that they're not applying because they can't find those child care resources? Or is it that they're just keeping folks home longer? Is it that moms and dads are not returning to work in other places or other sectors? Do we have any? I do know at last count that there were still about 2 million women who are still sitting out of the workforce, which could account for some of that factor. But I'm just curious if we have any ideas on what else might be contributing to that.
Chair Nor, Representative, you know, it's a challenging thing for us to know reasons for people that we do not serve because it's an absence of data, right? Anecdotally, I think all of the above likely. There are a lot of contributing factors to why childcare, the uptake isn't coming back up, and the workforce could certainly be one large item where people can't even find childcare. It also could be that people are choosing not to send their children to childcare. So I think it's yet to be known. We certainly want to know the answer to that question, but it is a concerning trend that we're seeing, but it's an unknown.
I'll go next to Lee, and you, Brenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I can wait my turn. just to clarify that 2 million number, maybe that's nationally. It can't be 2 million women in the state of Minnesota. We've only got a population of a little over 5. Okay. My question is, going back to slide 18, Mr. Greenman, you were talking about the grant expenditures, and these are as a the slide is laid out as a percentage. It's all funds, so I assume that that includes federal funds for federal grant programs, and that's $2.47 billion. My question to you, obviously over the summer we saw extraordinary fraud in this segment, particularly with nutrition and housing. I mean, if we're looking at $2.47 billion all funds, that means about 10% was found to be, we were told by the attorney, the district attorney, the federal attorney, that it's at least $250 million in fraud. So that's about 10%, which is really significant for these grant programs. Obviously, particularly with the fraud that we saw this summer, that was money intended to feed children. So I am wondering what safeguards, what changes are in place now to ensure that that is not going to happen moving forward. Obviously, the Feeding Our Future fraud was its own thing, but what changes, what very specific changes have you made moving forward to ensure that this is not happening in our grant programs?
Just wanted to make sure that there's a difference between the fund that went through MDE and the programs that we're talking about DHS. They're totally different, and I will let CFO Greenman to respond.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as Representative Neuer said, this is a different fund, but nevertheless, obviously it's critically important that the dollars that go out our door for grants or for any other reason go out for the right reasons, they're used for the purpose that they were intended, and that we're making sure that we're good stewards of state taxpayer dollars. There's always a risk that something will happen that's not as it was intended. I think we as an agency have put particular focus on making sure that we're being as our commissioner would say, dotting our I's and crossing our T's, and making sure that we've got our compliance pieces in place. I'd say we could always do better. I think we've reduced a lot of the funding in terms of our audit findings. I think we've done a very good job of reducing that. That said, any dollars that go out the door that that aren't meant for where they're supposed to go is too many dollars. But we have been working very hard to try to address that. I think I can't really speak to the situation involving the Feeding Our Families, but we've been certainly that experience has gotten us to look more carefully at, you know, who we use to manage our dollars. If we use a third-party intermediary, that doesn't happen very often at DHS. So that situation where that occurred isn't really something that occurs at DHS. But we have an internal audits unit. We do a lot of our oversight of our own agency. We're subject to the OLA as well as the federal government. So I can't, like I said, I can't speak to that particular one, but I can say that we absolutely do our absolute best, and it's a really high priority for us to make sure that we're trustworthy. That's the one word that Commissioner Harpstead brought with her when she came, was a focus on trustworthiness. That's what 2.47 billion is. A lot of money, and it's a lot of money that came to us very quickly, without a lot of warning because of COVID. Like I said when I was presenting, that's a doubling of our grant budget in a very short period of time. So that put a lot of stress on our staff to get those dollars out the door. And during COVID, frankly, we were being told to get these dollars out the door in 3 weeks. That's not really something that we're well suited to do, but we tried to do it. So it's been a challenge, but I think we tried to focus on fraud prevention or you know, misallocation of funds, whatever you want to put it. And I think we've got more to go, but I think we've made a lot of effort to improve things.
Follow up, Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And I appreciate that, the idea of being much more careful about crossing our I's and dotting our T's. I would just be curious, and perhaps we can do this offline, but I'd be very curious to know what specific measures are being taken to ensure that that's the case. And I am sympathetic to how quickly you were trying to get money out the door, but the OLA report on the homelessness money was really atrocious, and it was exactly about not crossing T's and dotting I's. It was exactly saying there was just no paperwork. And now the commissioner has assured us that all of that was done legitimately, but without a paper trail, how do we know that? You know, I mean, all we're doing is she is taking the word of employees, and we are taking her word. But that's not a good way to do business. So I would just be curious, like I said, we can take it offline, but I would really like, and I think that Minnesotans would really like to know, what specific measures are being taken to ensure that those details are being paid attention to. Thank you.
Representative Neuer, I appreciate the question, Representative. I think we rely on you to watch over us and make sure we're doing the right thing. I think the shelter grants, I think the one thing I would say is we did go back and check to make sure all of the spending was actually went out the door for the purposes for which it was intended. You're right, there was definitely some findings in the OLA report. The one thing I would say is that area of the agency that managed that grant was managing in 2021 and 2022 more grant dollars than the entire agency in 2019. And they were getting that pressure with almost no warning. And so I don't dispute with you what you're saying about the audit. I think that was, you know, there's definitely things we can make improvements on, but I would just say that, you know, we did the best we could at the time. There's ways we can improve things. We've learned a lot. I'm happy to have conversations with you more about it, about what we've done and what specifically we're doing, because I think your input is incredibly important in this. So I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Thank you, Lead New Brindley. We have 10 minutes, and I've got 10 people on the list, so you've got one question to ask, and we'll go to the next one. Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to go back a little bit here to the federal Medicaid medical assistance percentages. That extra 6.2% we got during the COVID, it's going to start wrapping up. As I see it, that 6% gives us roughly an extra $1 billion maybe to work with through that period of time. I might be up or down a little bit, but it's a pretty significant number because the numbers are so large. And with so many nursing homes right now in dire situations, I know a couple last week have closed that I've been aware of in rural Minnesota. Do you really know, and again, Mr. Grimmon, you were talking a little bit that frightened me about making the budget work and you're not rehiring people or you're filling staff levels. So when you say that, when the extra money's coming in, made me sort of pause going, I'm really confused. My folks at home, and I've shared this with other meetings here, that a lot of our county public health folks are very frustrated because they're not getting answers quick enough from whether it's licensing questions, whether it's deployments, grants, whatever it is. And if you're not meeting your budget with extra dollars flying in, sometimes faster than what we're used to doing, right, which is unusual, did we spend the money? Is it still part of that billions of dollars on the bottom line? Are we tracking the extra spending in some of those areas that I maybe mentioned, nursing homes, long-term care, disabilities? Now that we can kind of settle back and look back at what we just went through, are we seeing, did we spend the monies and increasingly the proportions of the new dollars coming? Are we able to sort of see how those decisions were made, right or wrong? I think our constituents really want to know how we did all this. Mm-hmm. Nursing homes are a crisis mm-hmm. level, and others are too. Did we spend the money? If so, did we track where it went?
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, those are really good questions. And I guess one thing I want to just be clear on, the operating dollars that the agency has in which to hire people to pay for our operating costs in our central office are separate. They're segregated. You appropriate them for that very narrow purpose. They don't cross with Medicaid. When we get the extra federal funds through the extra higher FMAP rate through Medicaid, that doesn't come into that budget. It's not available to us for any of that work, and it shouldn't be. It should be available for Medicaid to pay for services for people. So we're trying to set our budget within that narrow operating dollars that you said, and that's where we have to make difficult decisions around how we're going to stay within our budget. On the enhanced match on the Medicaid funds, that actually comes to the state general fund. That just goes right to the general fund, and it goes to the bottom line, to the surplus. So you actually make the decision about how to spend those dollars. It's a lot of that additional revenue is it's what we call non-dedicated revenue. That means it doesn't go to DHS. It offsets the cost of the service, and because the feds are paying, we're going to pay the same amount for medical assistance regardless of who pays for it. Because the feds are paying an extra 6.2%, that means we're not paying that 6.2%. That means we're saving money, and it's going into the general fund. And you're making those decisions about how those dollars get spent.
So, quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, really quick. I know. So you're saying we didn't spend more money in those areas. They lowered our obligation to it, so we didn't actually spend more. Because I think that's what's maybe a little bit alarming. Do I have that right,
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker? I don't. What I would say is that the additional federal funding increased the size of the state budget surplus, the general fund budget surplus, and then you decide how to spend the state budget, obviously, the general fund. So I don't know that I can draw a direct link between the federal funds coming in and what you decide to spend the money on. So whether that's what I'm trying to say is there's not a direct link. But it actually does increase the size of the surplus or the balance in the state budget.
Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to go back to some of the slides, if you would even point me to them, about kind of our aging population and how that is going to be affecting our budget in the future, which is, there's choices that we make, but we're saying, right now, the biggest amount of money that we're spending is because disability and age. And we know, it's funny word, baby boomers, when you're sitting here, not a baby anymore. But yeah, baby boomers are coming for a long time, and that they're living longer and costing more because they're not always healthy. So, I think it's probably like the sobering look right now of what we can think about in the future of what that looks in terms of the cost to the state.
Erica Bain.
Chair and Representative Pryor, that's a very good observation, and definitely something that we've been talking about for several years on what does the baby boomer population aging mean when it comes to having the right service mix available to people across the state to ensure that we can appropriately provide services in the way that they want and the way that fits them. and to have adequate, you know, funding for them. So you'll see in the, it's what, this slide is really telling, because not only is it more people that we're serving, but it's really about where people want to receive those services. And so I think there's some really big decisions that this committee will have to make on where you want to put your investments and where are particular areas in long-term care sector that we know have really hard workforce challenges. Honing in on those particular kind of worst off rate methodologies or services where people are finding a lack of access to care, because going forward, not only do we have a workforce shortage, but we have more people we need to serve. And so we're kind of hit with a double whammy in this sector more than others, where everyone's kind of forced to handle the challenges around workforce, but this in particular because of that baby boomer generation. So we would love to have a more in-depth conversation about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we need accurate data. On slide 26, where you've got the MA enrollment distribution throughout the state, it's impossible for the state of Minnesota to have a lower percentage of population on MA than any of the regions. I'm calculating instead of 19.8, it's got to be at least 22.1. All the other ones are above 20. And when you, you know, do confirm and correct the data, can you also give us some demographic information of why there's such a disparity between some of the regions, so we can better understand disparity and delivery of services and that? Thank you.
We'll follow up on that. The next person is Chair Fish.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. I will be very quick. Mine is more of a comment, and that's going back to when the issue was around housing services. As well, the OLA found that the paperwork was missing, the department went back, collected the paperwork, and after all that paperwork was reviewed, it was found that there was no fraud at that point in time. I can say, having talked to people who received these grants, that the state does go out and do physical on-site inspections and reviewing things. They don't always remember to bring back the paperwork with them. And I think part of that comes back to what we heard earlier, is that we've not adjusted for inflation in this area. And we've heard many times where we as the legislature have authorized extra positions, but to make up for the increase in lease costs and utilities and all that type of thing, instead of bringing the positions on board, they're having to cover these other costs. Where if we accounted for inflation, they would be able to bring up their staffing to the point that they need, so that they can have the people out there to make sure that they aren't having to go back and redo things back and forth. And from having heard these presentations in other committees, that's one of the problems, is that we're at such a low percentage for people here, they can't always get to doing the work they'd like to. They're having to rush it, and we need to make sure we fix this part of the problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, for that clarity. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Chair. So just real quick about the workforce issue, just in on accountability, how many of your state employees are back in person? As I've been meeting with, you know, different counties and things like that, are all your employees back in person? So they're going into homes, they're going in to do their assessments, things like that. Are they still working remotely? That was my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we probably want to get back to you about that. I don't know the specific details, but I think we can certainly get an answer to you on that.
We'll get the commission on Tuesday, so hopefully we can get that answer.
Thank you so much.
Representative Frank.
There'll be many opportunities for my question down the road. It's fine.
Thank you so much. The last but not the least, Representative Zelensky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Greenman, I'm just wondering, I'm looking at the expenditures for grants and understand it, and I think it's great that it looks to me like the federal government gave us more in 2021, 22, 23, which I assume is due to the pandemic. And I'm just wondering the numbers served. You mentioned homelessness, nutritional assistance, and I believe child format of subsidies. And wondering what benchmarks, you know, do we have to show some successful outcomes we did with that in this trying time is one of my questions. And then Yeah, I think it's great that we you had to get money out in 3 weeks. I wish we would have got it in long-term care, and these facilities are hurting. So I just want to know that we have the benchmarks for these grant programs, and we have the accountability for the public and the clients and families. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we can certainly get that for you. I think that the specific program areas would have that kind of information. I don't have it with me right now, but we can certainly get that for you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
With that, I just wanted to say thank you to CFO Greenman and Director Bailey for the presentation and to the DHS. Members, we have a lot of work to do, and the budget that you have seen is what we will be planning to make sure that we fully fund some of the programs of the department and make sure that we take care of those who need the most. So with that, no further agenda items. We are adjourned.